Welcome to the Transforming Aging Summit 2015, where conscious aging experts are gathering to shift the paradigm of aging to one of vast potential infused with vitality, passion, purpose, continual growth, and service, all to help you make your later years your best years. We appreciate you sharing this information with your friends and family. And now, founder and director of the Center for Conscious Eldering, and organizer of the Conscious Aging Alliance, and author of Conscious Living, Conscious Aging, your host, Ron Pevney.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Transforming Aging Summit, featuring leaders whose wisdom and work are transforming the face of aging in today's world. I am your host, Ron Pevney. We're delighted that you're joining us for this summit and for this session with our special guest, Richard Leiter. Richard is going to be sharing with us his extensive and passionate understandings of the theme of purpose. Session title is How to Unlock Your Purpose. I'd like to read a little bit of Richard's very rich bio. Richard Leiter, founder of Inventure, the Purpose Company, is one of America's preeminent executive coaches. Richard's 9 books, including 3 bestsellers, have sold over 1 million copies and have been translated into 20 languages. And Repackaging Your Bags and The Power of Purpose are considered classics in the personal development field. As co-author of Life Reimagined, Richard is the chief curator of content for AARP's Life Reimagined Institute. And widely viewed as a visionary and thought leader on the power of purpose, Richard's work is featured regularly in many media sources, including PBS Public Television and NPR Public Radio. And for 30 years, Richard has led Inventure Expedition walking safaris in Tanzania, East Africa. So, Richard, we are honored that you're joining us today. We've heard various of our speakers in this summit stress the importance of purpose in living healthy, vital lives. And when many of us, including myself, think of it, of what it means to live with purpose, we think of you and your powerful books on this theme. So thank you so very much for joining us today, Richard.
It's a real privilege, Ron. Thank you for having me.
Richard, I guess what I'd like to begin with is definitions. You know, on this summit, we have three wonderful experts on healthy aging and healthy longevity who have, each in their own unique way, shared with us what they see as the most critical factors in healthy longevity. And all of them say that having a strong purpose and then being productive and creative in ways that reflect that purpose is perhaps the most important factor in aging well, aging healthily, and aging long. And so we hear from a lot of people, you know, the word purpose is tossed out a whole lot out there. I'd like to ask you, what does purpose mean to you?
Well, it's something that I've been studying and passionate about for, as you know, 4 decades, and sometimes you hear in the popular conversation out there, get a life. Well, I say get a purpose in life, and here's why. Purpose is fundamental, as we know, to health, healing, happiness, and longevity, and we talk a lot about, I call it the 3 M's, money, medicine, and meaning. We need enough money to live along healthy life. We need enough, not medicine per se, but health. But we also need meaning. It's fundamental. So my definition of purpose is very simple. It's this. What is your reason for getting up in the morning? If you don't have a clear reason, aim outside of yourself, and that's the key ingredient, outside of yourself for getting up in the morning, you don't live as long and you're not as healthy, happy, and productive. So it's the central aim, the core theme of what we get up in the morning for.
And I think what you just said, a purpose outside of yourself, seems so
right.
really so very critical. And I'm thinking of a friend of mine who believes, you know, he's retired, and he believes that he has a purpose. And his purpose is that he decided sometime right after he retired that every year he was going to see if he could get 50 days in on the slope skiing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that gets him up in the morning.
Yeah.
And he does it
to my mind,
to the point of obsession. Yeah, it's a goal, but it doesn't seem to me that it's a purpose. And what's the difference between a goal and a purpose?
A purpose is our intention. It's our aim. It's like pointing to the moon. Purpose is a direction or an aim. There are goals or steps to get there, and so it's ultimately our legacy, what we want to have our life be about. I started many years ago, and I've written about this extensively, interviewing people over the age of 65. Now that I'm 70, I think I'll bump that up to 75. But I asked them the question: if you could live your life over again, what would you do? What would you do differently? And every time I've done this, and I'm just coming out now with a third edition of The Power of Purpose, and interviewed a lot of people for it. And there are three themes. The first theme is people said if they could live their life over, they would be more reflective the second time around. They'd step back and kind of look at the big picture. And I said, well, why didn't you do that along the way? And people said, well, I was busy. I was busy doing what I was doing, making a living or raising a family or whatever it was. And that usually it was a crisis, a wake-up call of some sort that caused them to push the pause button and reflect. So part of purpose is stepping back and seeing the larger picture, in spite of the fact that I said it's about why you get up today. It's in the context of the larger picture of what really matters in life. And the second theme is courage. People said if they could live their life over again, they would take more risks the second time around. And this was not financial risks or skiing risks or whatever. It was the risk of authenticity. People wish they would have been more, where they have the most regrets are in work and love, work and relationships. When you ask people what is a purpose in life, it almost ultimately always gets down to relationships and our impact on others outside of ourself. And I wish I would have been more authentic in my marriage, my child rearing, my colleagues at work, brought more of myself to the table. And the third theme was with the elders was if I could live my life over, and this was the biggie for me, I wish I would have been clearer about what really matters earlier in life, my purpose. And every human being that I've ever interviewed, no matter what goals they have, wants to make a difference, wants their life to matter, wants to leave a thumbprint, a footprint, or as the late Steve Jobs said, make a dent in the universe. So the key is what is your dent, what is your thumbprint, your footprint? That is fundamental to us as human beings, regardless of what lifestyle we may choose to live in any age.
And you know, there's so many people, at least in my perception, and I know that we can't judge others, know what's going on in their hearts, but I think there are so many people who don't have a sense of purpose in the life-enhancing way that you describe it. Some of them are not even aware that they lack it or that it matters, but others, especially as they near so-called retirement age, really feel some grief about that,
Yep.
It's missing.
Mortality.
And I need it. I know I need it. How do you find that if you realize that you just don't have it?
Well, that's a big question. How do you find it? That's my life's work. But purpose is first and foremost, it's a choice. And the instructor the first real wake-up for me on that was when I graduated from counseling psychology graduate school trying to figure out what to do with the rest of my life. You'd think you'd figure that out in school counseling, but it's always about other people. And as I was trying to figure out what's next, I saw a poster in the graduate school hallway of a seminar that was coming up in San Diego the following month. And it was a week-long seminar with Viktor Frankl, who wrote Man's Search for Meaning. And so I didn't have any money, and I didn't. I had actually studied Frankl in school. I had read Man's Search for Meaning. We discussed it. But I went down there. I scraped together enough money, and I went down there and spent a week with Viktor Frankl. And it changed the trajectory of my life forever. For those that don't know Frankl, he was in the same stable of thinkers as Freud and Jung and Adler and others. And but he founded a school of thought called logotherapy or meaning therapy. And in the midst of his training residence in Vienna, medical psychiatric residence in Vienna, he was taken by the Nazis, as was his whole family. He was in three concentration camps. His entire family perished. And he survived, and he was liberated, and he went back to weighing 87 pounds, not very good shape. He went back to Vienna, healed, sat down, wrote Man's Search for Meaning in 9 days. And the core lesson I learned when I spent a week with Frankl, I mean, it was riveting. Every word, I mean, you could hear a pin drop the whole week. But the central theme was the last of the human freedoms is choice. It's to choose what you want your life to be about, regardless of the circumstances you're in. And, of course, a concentration camp is the most unbearable circumstance that most of us could ever imagine. And he said the reason that a lot of people survived, not everybody, of course, was that they did have a reason to get up in the morning beyond themselves, to give somebody else a kind word, a crust of bread, a hug, to envision a purpose outside of here when they got out of the concentration camp to with their loved ones and things like that. That's what kept people alive. I submit that my work has uncovered that that's true for people today. But we have to choose it. We have the free will to make the choice of what we want that life to be about. So it's purpose is about our mindset, our worldview, our point of view of how we come at life, and how we embrace it or not. And if it's all about us, if it's a life of self-absorption, we all know what it's like to be around people who are takers rather than givers. And so that freedom of choice is the first part to unlocking the power of purpose in people's lives. And there are others, I'll stop there, but there are other steps beyond choice, but it starts with choice.
Yeah, choice is what sets us on the path. It helps to start a whole process in motion for us.
Right.
And so if someone, Richard, makes that choice that I am going to live my life with a purpose that is larger than just me, can you suggest a few steps that people might take to get a sense of how they can best become aware of what unique gifts they have that can somehow intersect with some real needs out there beyond them so that indeed they can live with purpose? How can one begin to explore the possibilities once one is committed to moving in that direction?
Yep. Well, first of all, I'll do that. It's called the napkin test. It's real quick. But before I do the napkin test with your listeners, let me just suggest that there are three myths that people hold about purpose. One myth is that you have to have a cause greater, you know, you have to save the planet, so to speak. There's a great quote about purpose that I really love from the American essayist E.B. White, who said, "I arise in the morning, torn between a desire to save the world and a desire to savor the world. This makes it hard to plan the day." Well, in all due respect, So again, I arise in the morning torn between a desire to improve or save the world and a desire to enjoy or savor the world. This makes it hard to plan the day. I think it makes it easier to plan the day because I think it's a truth that a well-lived life is about both saving and savoring. So someone who skis 50 days a year is savoring. But what about the save part? And the save part does not have to mean that he has to join a cause or anything, but make a contribution to community. We are tribal animals. We're herd animals. We live in community. And so part of our survival and our thriving is to be able to play our part in that community beyond our own self-interest. But you don't have to have a cause to do that. Just have to have a mindset to do that. The second myth is that purpose is a revelation. That somehow those lucky ones who have found a sense of purpose it's been revealed to them in some way. It's only revealed through actions. Purpose is a verb. We act in the world on things, and from that comes meaning. And some people might get a revelation, but it's few and far between, I've found. Third thing is that purpose say, well, it's a luxury. It's only for the affluent, or it's only for those that have the time and the wherewithal. But actually, as I said in my opening remarks, purpose is not a luxury. It is fundamental. Without a reason to get up in the morning, we simply don't live as long, and we don't have as healthy and happy a life. So it's not a luxury. It's a fundamental. So back to the what do I do with that context. A lot of people, when they find out what I do, kind of jokingly will say to me, "You got a minute? Can you tell me what I ought to do with the rest of my life?" So I call it the Got a Minute quiz and the napkin test. And I say, take out a napkin and write down these three letters. G plus P plus V equals C. G, the letter G, plus P, the letter P, plus V, the letter V as in Victor, equals C, calling. So what that stands for and what is essential for us to answer at any phase of our life is, first of all, what are our gifts? That's the G. What are the natural, born, spontaneous, enjoyed talents that we have that we love to give to others, that we give to the world in certain ways? When I ask people if they have brothers and sisters, they say yes. I say, are your brothers and sisters' gifts the same as yours? And they laugh right out loud, saying, no, totally different. And I said, when did you start to notice the differences? And they said, well, way back when we were kids. You know, this one was a mechanic, and this one was a musician, and this one was selling lemonade, and this one was doing something different. So gifts differing. We all have different gifts. So the second letter is P, passions. Passions are, what are you curious about? What do you care about? What needs doing in your family, your community, your faith organization, your world, that if you could get up in the morning and in some small way use your gifts to, in the service of, outside of yourself, in the service of something that you care about, that'd be a good reason to get up in the morning for at least part of your day or part of your week or part of your month. So gifts plus passions, and then the third letter is values. Values are where you do what you do. It's the kind of organization or the kind of way you like to operate in the world. So if we know our gifts and we know our passions and we know our values, we have a pretty good shot at putting together a purpose, a reason to get up in the morning. So G plus P plus V equals C, calling. And calling is an age-old term that's been around in theology and philosophy forever, but calling is a summons or that inner urge to give our gifts away. So I find that people say, oh, do you do this for kids? I got a kid who's got a great education but's clueless about this formula. And I said, well, what about you? You know, it's a cradle-to-grave thing. It's not just about a job that you get paid to do. It's about caregiving. It's about community. It's about somehow serving others beyond ourselves in some small way from cradle to grave. So that's the napkin test.
And so I'm looking at the test here.
Sense of purpose. Pardon?
No, I'm just looking at the napkin test here, and you know, I'm realizing that you said a moment ago that for most people, purpose doesn't come as some great epiphany. You know, you go out in the desert for a while and meditate, and there it comes. Even though I think some elements of that can happen.
I'm not saying it can't happen.
But we can seek it. Yes, but what I hear you saying, Richard, is that for most of us, to get in touch with our gifts or our passions as you define them, or the kind of values, you know, how we can somehow do this, it really takes a lot of willingness to maybe step out of our normal habitual routines and comfort zones and actually get out there and experiment. We may not know what we're passionate or curious about, and just sitting around pondering it may well not do it, but if we go out and just give ourselves a whole pile of diverse experiences with no expectations, that lo and behold, if we really do this with self-awareness, we'll begin to get a sense of this stirs me a little bit, or this seems to be a gift I have to give. But it takes a lot of experimentation, right?
Well, and it's living in the right question, Ron. And Viktor Frankl taught me that it's not about what is the purpose of life, what is the meaning of life. The wrong question. The question is, what is life asking of me? What is life asking of me today? And so, as I said earlier, purpose is a verb. Purpose is an action in the world. One of my colleagues is a guy named Chris Gardner. Chris Gardner was, if any of the listeners ever saw the movie The Pursuit of Happiness, Chris Gardner was a homeless African-American man with a young child living in subways in San Francisco, trying to figure out how to make a living, and really down and out homeless. And the book The Pursuit of Happiness and the movie The Pursuit of Happiness, played by Will Smith, by the way, who was up for an Academy Award for it when it came out. But Chris Gardner's central theme in The Pursuit of Happiness is start where you are. Start where you are now. Act. As I said, purpose is a verb. Start to act purposefully, and the theme of purpose will show up in the purpose moments in life. Every moment is a purpose moment. It's not a big epiphany. Even a big legacy, it is a legacy question, but ultimately, purpose, every moment's a purpose moment. Am I a giver or a taker in this moment? And it's always a choice, as Frankl said. I always say, all this purpose thing seems so big, and then I said, okay, let me give you a default purpose. The default purpose that I found that works for people to help discover purpose or unlock it for themselves is this. Your purpose in life is to grow and to give. Now, that seems pretty simple. Are you growing and are you giving? If you're growing and giving, you're on purpose. Your mindset is, your trajectory is set in a purpose direction.
Well, I think that is really clarifying for me, and I imagine for a lot of our listeners, Richard, who sometimes think that purpose is some grand design or grand calling, and that we're not really living on purpose until we've somehow discovered that grand design or grand calling. But I think what you're helping us to see is that, or at least the way I'm understanding what you're sharing, is that purpose rather is more of a commitment to living fully and contributing in each moment in whatever each situation presents. And if we're living on purpose in that way, then we're on track. And we may or may not then get some sense of a grander calling. But if every action can be in service to this commitment to purpose, then we're well on our way.
Yep, that's exactly right. And I've learned about purpose from a lot of different people and a lot of different angles. I've studied it in school. I even went back to the seminary at one point for a year to study purpose in world religions and theology. Newest chapter in the third edition of Power of Purpose, which, as I said, is coming out this fall, is Can Science Explain Purpose? And what we're finding, and so I looked at it from a scientific angle, a medical angle, a theological angle, but science, and particularly the neurosciences, are figuring out that when people have purpose, there's a neurological transference in the brain. There are things that happen to brain plasticity. So I've written about Alzheimer's and purpose. I've written about other factors. And I had lunch a couple years ago with the happiest man in the world, according to the media. If you Google happiest man in the world, this is the name that will come up, Matthew Ricard. And Matthew Ricard, I'm a senior fellow. One of my roles in life is a senior fellow at the Center for Spirituality and Healing, which is in the Academic Health Center at the University of Minnesota. It's their integrative medicine department or program. And Matthew Ricard had come to town to give a lecture at the university to a sold-out audience. And the story of Ricard, in a nutshell, is quite interesting. But they asked me, as a senior fellow, if I would take him to lunch and then introduce him. And he's the happiest man in the world for this reason, because at these neuroscience labs, like the University of Wisconsin Laboratory and others, where they put on what they call the God helmet, they connect you up to a brain scan, brainwave machine, and then they ask you certain questions or ask you to meditate or ask you different things, and then they measure the brainwave activity. They look at your blood samples and all this kind of scientific study. And they found that he blew the test. His neurons fired more than anybody else up there. So, And Ricard, by the way, is a Buddhist monk. He was a former scientist himself at the Pasteur Institute in France. He's a Frenchman. And at a fairly young age, late 20s, early 30s, he went on a spiritual odyssey to India, and he never came back. He stayed, studied, became a Buddhist monk, eventually became the Dalai Lama's translator, and traveled the world with the Dalai Lama, whom he's still close to. And so I have to take this guy to lunch and introduce him. So I take him to lunch. He's dressed in his Buddhist robes and a shaved head, and he looks the part, and I'm dressed normally for, you know, standard day. And so we're standing in the hallway at this little lunch place, the two of us, and I turned to him and I said, "Matthew, how do you get to be the happiest man in the world?" And he paused, and he looked at me, and he smiled, and he said only one word: practice. I said, practice. And he said, "Yes, you learn purpose, and you learn happiness through practice." And I said, "What is your central practice?" And he said, "Compassion." He said, "All world religions, all purpose, the bottom line or the central feature is compassion." And I think that's what Frankl taught. That's what many people taught. And so happiness, purpose, longevity, I think ultimately the core of purpose is compassion. It's for the sake of others or for the sake of something beyond ourselves, as I said before. Without it having to be a cause, it can be just be in the purpose moment to listen to another person, to give a pat on the back, a kind word, to offer something to a homeless person, or whatever it might be that calls to you at that particular purpose moment. And our life is nothing more than purpose moments, choice points. And the wise sages and yogis and spiritual leaders throughout history have all taught pretty much the same thing. compassion.
So would I be accurate, Richard, in saying that if you dedicate yourself to practicing compassion in each moment, practice compassion and purpose will naturally follow?
That's precisely right.
Beautiful, beautiful. Thank you for
From
that.
From my point of view, yeah, like, I mean my observation as a student of it, yes, I agree totally with what you said.
Yeah. I'd like to shift a little bit. You mentioned Odyssey a little while ago. You've been going to Tanzania for about 30 years. You've spent extensive time with and developed friendships with elders of the Maasai people and the Hadza people. And I assume you don't go for 30 years just to enjoy the scenery and the wildlife. You're learning a whole lot from your time with these people and with the elders of these people. And so could you take a few moments to share some of what you feel is most important of what you've learned from these indigenous elders?
Yeah, my company, as you mentioned, that I founded and I still am a founder and practitioner in is called InVenture, the Purpose Company, and these are called InVenture Expeditions. So there is an adventure part, like trekking and animals and wilderness and things like that, but the InVenture part of it is what people go on my trips for and what and the reason I go in addition to the adventure. And I call the subtext or the theme of these is called Back to the Rhythm. And I say, and people say, what is this back to the rhythm thing that you keep talking about? And I said, this is before we go. I said, you know, it's very hard to explain back to the source, back to the core, back to the core of ourselves, but that's what it is, back to the rhythm. It's not to, and so when you get there, tell me when you get it. And it takes about 3 days for people to slow down. I ask them to put their watches away and to, you know, just go with the flow. And about 3 days into it, all of a sudden, their face looks different. The lines seem to have eased in their face. Their eyes seem brighter. I said, what's going on? I said, you know, back to the rhythm. I haven't had a time like this where I've been away from my cell phone, away from other people, away from expectations, to really be with myself in a place that's so pristine and beautiful and natural and... So the back to the rhythm part is what the trips are all about. And we sit around the fire with elders and others from different tribes. And over the decades, the 3 decades I've been spending a month every year over there, I've had many, many experiences that I've written about and speak about. And but one of the experiences that I think you in particular, Ron, and I think your listeners in particular would be interested in, that there's a tribe over there called the Hadza. You can learn more about them if you go to the National Geographic website or you Google Hadza, H-A-D-Z-A. And they're called by many or most the original people. They've been doing these genome tests where they sample indigenous tribes all over the world. And they find that that their blood tests, their tracking, goes all the way back to these original people in many ways. And so the Hadza have been around for, let's say, they don't know precisely, but, 75,000 years. And they're a total sharing culture. They're a total collaborative culture. It's not about competition. It's about collaboration. If you go and you're with the Hadza, and there are only about 1,300 of them left on the planet, and they live in a area called the Lake Eyasi Basin below the Serengeti, south of the Serengeti Plains, where it drops off into a very arid baobab forest and soda lake area called Lake Eyasi. So I wanted to... meet these people for so long, but they really weren't open until about 20 years ago to outside visits. And so finally my guide partner over there and I got the chance to meet and then eventually a few years later bring a first group down there. And so that's been going on and I've been learning from them and my guide partner, who is an icon in the guiding world in East Africa, wrote over the years, the seminal book on the Hadza in their own voices, an elder council was selected, self-selected, of men and women to tell their story, because heretofore it had been all researchers doing their story, but they wanted to tell their own story about who they were and what they do and what they believe in. And so he actually wrote that book, and which is out. And a couple years ago, I was sitting around the fire with a Hadza elder, and I was interviewing them to learn more about elderhood, and very seminal to our discussion here with this topic. And this one elder, his name is Kampala, very sprightly. They're quite small and short people, and a very sprightly guy, somewhere in his 80s. They don't even remember when they were born. They don't keep score that way, but he's in his 80s, according to most people. And he's an elder that is very esteemed for holding the oral traditions and wisdom of the Hadza. And so he said, "Richard, could we step away from the fire for a minute here? I want to ask you a personal question outside of the group here." I said, "Sure." And so we stepped away from the fire, and he's holding my hand there, very touch-oriented. He's holding my hand. He's very excited. And because supposedly I'm this person who writes these books, and has am sort of the elder in another culture, and at least in his eyes. And so he said, "Richard, you know what the two most important days in your life are?" I said, "Sure, Kampala, birth and death." And I did this through a translator. I can actually speak Swahili, but he speaks an ancient Klik language, a Khoisan or a Klik language, in which very few people speak, and I don't, other than a few words. I said, "Yeah, birth and death." And he looked down, and he was disgruntled. He said, "Oh, man." He said, "You come all the way over here in an airplane. You came all the way out here in a Land Rover. You're sleeping over there in that tent. You got this nice pack. And you don't know the answer to the most essential question." And I said, "Well, okay, Kampala, clue me in. What is it?" He said, "Well, you got the first one right, birth. But in our tradition, and the reason we've survived for all these years, the second answer to the question, the first is the most important day is, of course, birth and surviving birth over there, because infant mortality is a big thing. Second most important day in our tradition is the day that you determine why you were born, why you're here, what you're here to do, how you fit into the culture, what is your voice in the community, so to speak." So it gets back to that E.B. White quote of saving and savoring, he said, "What is your saving or what is your contribution?" And so here I am with a guy who's never been more than 50 kilometers from where we're standing, who's sharing with me an ancient truth and principle of their culture. And it's the same thing that Frankl said, and it's the same thing that I learned at Harvard when I studied as part of the Harvard study of adult development, that having a reason to get up in the morning and figuring out how that fits into community is fundamental to our survival even and thriving as human beings, not just for a good life.
So well, that beautiful was big.
That
powerful,
was a huge,
powerful
huge
story, Richard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Richard, we're getting real short on time.
Okay. Sorry
I'd like
I went
to
on
post
so long,
you.
But Africa
no, no,
I could
no,
talk I, about the, for 2 hours.
No, that
you
was incredibly rich. I appreciate that. But just briefly speak to these two questions, if you will. Patricia says, "Can you say more about values in your napkin formula?" She says, "I heard you describe it as where you do what you do, but I'm not sure what that really means." And, for me, the word values, I don't usually equate that with where I do what I do. So say just a little bit more about values, if you will.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of research that says, and Gallup has got the most global millions of people research, that says only 1 out of 5 people wants to go to work every day. 4 out of 5 people don't want to get out of bed and go to work every day. They're not engaged in what they do. And so you may have your gifts and passions. Let's say it's your resume. you really know what your gifts are, you know what you're interested in. Now the key question is to find the place where you're going to live out that, where you're going to work. And so the number one knockout factor, I'm a career counselor by certification and by practice in my, you know, professional credentials. The number one factor in all knockout factor in all career research is culture. People don't leave organizations per se, they leave people. They can't stand the boss, they can't stand the team, they can't stand the values and the culture don't line up with who they are. So the V or the values is the fit. As a volunteer, for example, you could volunteer for an organization and be using your gifts on something you care about, but if the culture in that, let's say, nonprofit organization where you're volunteering, it doesn't value your voice, doesn't value your gifts and passions, isn't a good fit for you, you're not going to stay. You're not going to want to get up and go there and contribute your time or your talents or your money, for that matter. So the values is about the cultural fit or the place fit of where you do what you do.
In my own mind, I'm translating what you're saying to my mind. V could stand for venue as well as values.
It could stand for venue. Well,
yeah. Hey, one more quick question. If you could just take maybe a minute on this. This is from Rhea. And she says, what kinds of life purpose might those of us, you know, who are in the latter stages of life and who wish to be quiet and to savor each moment, and especially nature, how can we understand purpose? You know, if you're at a point in life where you really want to, you feel called to savor, then how does purpose fit into this?
Well, I think I go back to my default purpose, to grow and to give. To grow is to grow inside. And that means for some people it's sitting quietly in nature. For other people it means different. But we need to continually to listen, to be quiet, to reflect, to take solo time, to grow ourselves. Grow does not necessarily mean go to school or take a course or do anything that would perhaps be construed by that. And Rhea lives in community. It's what do you do with your insights? How do you play in the larger world, whether it's with your grandchildren or your children or your spouse or partner or your friends, but how do you contribute? One without the other, just growing is not in our human DNA. I think it's also a gift.
Okay, good. Thank you. That's been really helpful. I'd like to tell our listeners that Richard's newest book, as far as I know, Life Reimagined, written with Alan Weber, is an incredible book where some of the beautiful wisdom that Richard shared with us in this session can be found and is elaborated on even more. And people can get your book through most of the usual sources, right, Richard?
Yep, that's right.
And
that book, by the way, the first chapter in the book is called This Isn't What I Was Expecting. So many people got to a certain age and said, this isn't what I was expecting. I wasn't expecting I'd be dating online. I wasn't expecting I'd have to continue to work or even want to continue to work, or I'd be living with my kids or them with me, and on and on. And we, Alan Weber and I, read this book out loud to each other 50 times. We counted them so that it would read like a real conversation, not a preachy conversation or a self-helpy conversation. So Life Reimagined jumped the bestseller list in about 60 days because it is a real conversation, the way people really talk about themselves, particularly in the second half of life.
Well, I can see why it's on the bestseller list. I think it speaks to all of us in a way that's not academic or heady, but I think that really touches our heart and the reality of how we all seek purpose. Richard, thank you so very much. Your sharing has been so valuable to us, so inspirational, and thank you, and I wish you and your important work well as you move forward.
Thanks so much for a great interview, and I appreciate all you're doing as well, Ron. I hope we cross paths again in person sometime soon.
Well, I hope I can get to Africa with you sometime, Richard. And to all of you who are listening to this session, thank you for listening. And we invite you to please be sure to join us for the next session in the Transforming Aging Summit. Begin shortly, and until then, be well.
Thank you for joining us for the Transforming Aging Summit, brought to you by the Shift Network. For more information about joining our global community dedicated to helping people awaken to their divine humanity and take inspired action, visit www.theshiftnetwork.com. To learn more about the Amazing Aging Package, which is the online collection of top experts on conscious aging, or to add all of these interviews to your personal library, visit www.transformingagingsummit.com/upgrade. Thank you for sharing this summit with your friends and family. We appreciate your dedicated support.